This science show is about one man and one life, though it is a story with so much variety and surprise, you never know where you'll end up next. Hello, Robin Williams with another science show on ABC Radio National. Roger Short grew up in England, worked in Scotland, and has spent much of his later life in Melbourne, becoming a Fellow of the Royal Society and of our own Academy of Science. He trained as a vet, but branched out like the living legend he is. He was at Monash, but now resides at the University of Melbourne. And here he is.
Well, Robin, it all began on my mother's knee. And I can sort of remember it physically, but I certainly remember it intellectually with great clarity, because I had a copy, which I have here, of Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories. And every night before going to bed, my mother read to me aloud a chapter from Just So stories. And of course, the one that really entranced me was The Elephant's Child, and how the elephant got its trunk. And that's what I've ended up doing some research on.
Why won't you turn towards something more mechanical, engineering, you know, numbers, nuts and bolts and things like that? Why animals as such?
I think that was slightly parental revolt, because my father was an engineer, a mechanical engineer, an amazing man. Every single aircraft flying to this day depends for its navigation on my father's invention, which was the pitot head airspeed indicator. And I've got his original patent of 1912, and it's still unchanged on all aircraft. So he was a great inventor, and I had to do something that made me feel sort of different from him, although I was really in awe of him and thought he was a wonderful father. And so I decided to get involved in biology, and we were lucky to live on a tributary of the River Thames. So I spent every day of my life on my boat, which was called Imp, with my little dog Sam sitting in the bow, drifting down the river.
Messing about in boats.
Absolutely fantastic childhood. And that gave me a love of wildlife. And I got very interested in fish, and I found I was rather good because I could get up at dawn and go spinning in the Thames and catch these great big pike, which no one else could catch. And I thought, well, I don't want to kill them, I want to put them back, but I want to show someone I've caught them. So I gill tagged them. And at the age of 16, I wrote my first paper, which was a letter to the Field magazine on the growth and movement of pike in the Thames, by capture and recapture of my tagged pike.
Did they respond or print it?
Yes, they printed it, yes. And I was very thrilled.
Before we leave your home, what about your mother? Was she an academic as well?
No, she was a dairy maid. And my father had first met her when she was milking cows at the end of the First World War. He was working in Farnborough for the Royal Aircraft Establishment with his pitot tube airspeed indicators and other things. And Marion, my mother, was milking cows, and Dad fell instantly in love. And so my mother had no education, no tertiary education at all. I think she'd left school at about the age of 12. And she was a brilliant actress. And she set up an amateur dramatic society called the Coves, the Coventure Players. And every week we would read from start to finish an entire play with her colleagues in our house. And I took the small parts. And from that, I think I learnt, if I learnt anything, how to speak and how to use different tones of voice. And it was just an amazing experience. And I learnt so much of the English language, just from her.
Hence your flair for show business. I remember the launch of one of your books, the one about sex, where you had any number of people dressed up as Adam and Eve, and you had a stage setting, but we'll come to that. What about school? Now, school is often a very dicey business, because the hopes and ambitions can be thwarted.
No, my school days were strange. The war was on, and we lived just south of London. We're getting bombed. And my parents said, because by then I was an only child, my brother had died just before the war of rheumatic fever. my parents said, well, we're going to have to send you away from home, and we'll send you to a boarding school. And they sent me to Sherborne School in Dorset, which was a lovely place to be. I missed my parents terribly, but it was a great environment, and I became very friendly with a boy in the same form as me. We did English lessons together, and his name was David Cornwall, who you'd know as John Le Carre.
Exactly, yes.
And to have had your childhood with John, and we had a wonderful dinner in London just a couple of years ago, sort of reminiscing, because we hadn't met since we'd left school. And one day my mother came down to Sherborne School by train, no cars, of course, with a petrol shortage, and took me into the sort of village park, sat me down in a seat, which I went to the other day, it's still there, the very same seat, and said, now, Roger, what are you going to do with yourself? And I was 16. And I said, oh, I don't know, Mother. I'm very happy here. And she said, but what are you going to do? What's your future? And I said, I've got no idea. And she said, well, I will tell you. You're going to be a vet, but you'll never practice as a vet. You'll do research. And I said, oh, thank you very much, Mother. And that was it.
That's an astonishing insight, isn't it?
Isn't it? Incredible.
For someone with no proper education in the professional background, yes, of scientists.
If she'd had an education, by golly, what would she have been? An amazing woman.
I seem to recall there's only one Nobel laureate who trained as a veterinary scientist, and that's Peter Doherty. And then you went up to Cambridge. Was it all very straightforward?
Well, I went to Bristol first and did my veterinary degree in Bristol, which I enjoyed. And I knew that I was going to do something beyond it, so I started sort of doing bits of research, and I got fascinated by badgers and went out with some badger diggers. And badgers, you may know, mate in the spring in England, in February, and then the fertilised egg, the blastocyst, becomes dormant and fails to develop in the uterus from March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. And then suddenly in the beginning of January, the egg wakes up and there's a 2-month implanted gestation and the young are born in February. And so I was amazed to go out with this old badger digger, and we dug up a sow badger. He wanted it to eat, actually. And we put the dogs down the hole, and the dogs were barking. So we dug and dug. It took about 4 hours to dig down to this badger. And I remember him saying to me, and do we see Brock? Do we tap him on the nose? And so the badger was killed, and I opened it, and it was a sow badger. And there was the uterus with vague swellings along the uterine horn. And I opened the uterus up with my scissors. And there were these sort of 1 millimetre diameter pearls, these dormant blastocysts that had been there since February. And this was June when we were doing it. And I thought, how amazing. Gosh, what a sight. I mean, they really are the pearls of life. I'm going to be a reproductive biologist. So I owe a lot to that badger.
And then you end up to Cambridge?
And that took me first to the United States, actually. Having got my veterinary degree, I'd heard of these Fulbright scholarships. I thought, well, it would be exciting to go to America. And so I filled in an application for a Fulbright scholarship to go to the University of Wisconsin, where there was a very good reproductive group. And I was summoned for an interview at the US Embassy in London. And the rather daunting lady who interviewed me said, Mr. Short, I have to say, I have never seen such a carelessly written grant application. And I said, no, I quite agree. I've never read one that's quite as bad as mine either. And she said, what do you mean? I said, of course, I agree with you. I could have spent much more time on it. And somehow we became friends from that moment, and I got the scholarship.
How amazing.
So I spent a year in Wisconsin. And
You've learned, already you learned the way to charm people, to be a bit pixelated, but nonetheless get away with it.
Yes, if you could do something slightly unexpected, I think you often can break through. Just before I went to Bristol University. My father, when I was still at Sherborne School, sent me a letter one day. He didn't write to me very often. He sent me a letter which was just a quotation, Ralph Waldo Emerson's advice to the scholars of Dartmouth College. And I have it in my pocket because I've carried that with me every single day of my life. And here it is, much tattered, and it's all up here. And that was really a total inspiration to me.
What did Emerson say?
Gentlemen, I have ventured to give you the following considerations upon the scholar's place, and hope, because that standing, as many of you now do, on the threshold of this college, girt and ready to go assume tasks both public and private in your country, you will not be sorry to be admonished of the primary duties of the intellect, whereof you will seldom hear from the lips of your new companions. You will hear every day the maxims of low prudence. You will hear that your first duty is to get land and money, place and name. What is this truth you seek? What is this beauty? Men will ask with derision. If, nevertheless, God have called any of you to explore truth and beauty, be bold, be firm, be true. For the hour of that choice is the crisis of your history. And see that you hold yourself fast by the intellect. It is the domineering temper of the sensual world that creates the extreme need for the priests of science. Explore and explore. Be neither criticized nor flattered out of your position of perpetual inquiry. Make yourself necessary to the world, and mankind will give you bread, and if not store of it, yet such as shall not take away your property in all men's affections, in nature, in art, and in hope. What an amazing thing that Emerson produced for that graduation address.
Intellect and ideas versus materialism and indulgence.
Yes.
And that's been your kind of path?
Yes, sense? Absolutely. That's been my sort of guiding principle, really. And the strange thing is that Dad never asked me if I'd received the letter, and I never told him how much it meant to me. But it's still there in my pocket.
It's still with you after all these years. Let's finally get you to Cambridge, shall we? Magdalen College.
Yes, so Magdalen College, January the 1st, 1956. And I'm one of the sort of postgraduate students in Magdalen, and very happy there and have a lovely room. And I buy a little cottage in Grange Road, which has now been pulled down to build a college there. And I get married to the love of my life, Mary Wilson, a Welsh lass. And she was just finished doing medicine at Bristol, where we'd met first. And I worked in the Cambridge Vet School as a university lecturer, and was also doing a PhD, and became a member of Professor Thaddeus Mann's ARC, Agricultural Research Council, Unit of Reproductive Physiology and Biochemistry. And Thaddeus, who was a Pole who had fled from Poland because of the persecution there, he was a Catholic, actually, although I'd always imagined he was a Jew, but it turned out that he was a sort of covert Catholic, and wonderful supervisor. And he said, well, Roger, you can do anything you want. What would you like to work on? So I started working on measuring steroid hormones, and he supervised my research. He had no experience in that himself, but he'd come once a week and sit down with me and say, well, Roger, how is it going? And I remember once he said to me, Roger, you were on this scholarship. Do you think you have enough money? And I said, well, yes, of course I do. He said, are you sure? I said, yes, I don't need any more. And he said, oh, well, that's very nice to know. And it's such a lovely conversation. He was very concerned about me.
I'm sure he never heard a reply like that before. Now, you went on, did you not
with Mary Wilson to have a number of children?
Yes, so we had 4 children because this was the 1950s and the pill hadn't come in. And we had 4 children by accident. Each one was a surprise.
Population's always been on your mind, and I wonder how come that has been such a strong theme in some of your work.
Having 4 kids, and 2 by my second wife, Marilyn, since I came to Australia, did I feel guilty about the 4 in Cambridge? No, it didn't really dawn on me that, you know, there were too many of us. And one event happened that absolutely changed my thinking completely. I had this love, going back to Rudyard Kipling, of elephants. And I thought, well, working in the vet school, I'd heard from several people that every scientist ought to have a hobby project in addition to your main project. And I thought, well, my hobby project is going to be elephants. Why don't I take a sabbatical year's leave, which I was entitled to, and spend half of it in New York, working next to the Rockefeller, a cancer research institute, and going into Rockefeller every day. And the other half I'd spend in a remote little village in Uganda studying elephants. And I learned more in the 6 months in Uganda than I did in the 6 months in New York. And studying those elephants was just so amazing. It really blew my mind to be in the heart of Africa. We were, I think, 100 yards south of the equator. So I've crossed the equator more times than most people. And in the Queen Elizabeth National Park. And that love of elephants has persisted and is still with me.
But how did you actually get your hands on those elephants to study them? They can be quite dangerous to work with, especially the African ones.
I took my crossbow with me, which I've still got in the room over there. And I developed a dart. And I think I was the first person to dart and immobilize an elephant using this newly discovered morphine analogue, etorphine, or M99, which was developed in England. And I discovered that you could knock out an elephant with just 5 milligrams. So you only needed 0.5 milliliter of drug just injected intramuscularly. So I went about darting elephants. I put the first radio collar on an elephant. And when I went back to Cambridge, I found that lots of people were interested in elephants, so I got quite a few students who wanted to do PhDs with me on elephants. And one of these, my first, I think, John Hanks, went out to Zambia, where there was an elephant cropping scheme, and started collecting data. And the Zambian government objected to what he was doing, although the government were doing the culling. And he was put in protective custody, and I had to try and get him released, and I didn't know what to do. And I heard that Sir Peter Scott was visiting Cambridge, and I thought, well, Peter Scott knows Kenneth Kaunda very well.
He was the president.
The president. Kenneth could get my PhD student out. So I asked Peter Scott if he'd come to my office one evening, and he came at 6 o'clock. And he said, and this is a verbatim quote, he said, you know, when we started the World Wildlife Fund, its objective was to save endangered species from extinction. And I'm now near the end of my career, and we failed completely. We haven't saved a single endangered species. And if we'd put all that money we'd collected into condoms, we might have done some good. And I remember thinking, God, what a thought. Good heavens. Of course he's right. What am I doing here? Wasting my time in a vet school teaching horseshoeing to vet students. I really ought to be leading a research group in human reproduction and seeing if we can get contraception working and out there and available to everyone, because it's human population growth that's the transcending problem of our times. And to be able to remember that particular event and the evening, and I can even see Peter Scott's face as he said it, was, again, another life-changing moment for me.
I want to stick with elephants for a second. What made you think that they had been aquatic for a huge amount of the history of elephants?
When you go back to that beautiful drawing in Rudyard Kipling, this lovely drawing of the elephant in the great grey-green, greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees and his trunk being pulled by the crocodile. Kipling was aware of the aquatic nature of elephants. And through the cropping scheme in Zambia and a subsequent cropping scheme in South Africa in the Kruger National Park, we were able to collect elephant embryos, the smallest one being 0.5 milligram, the smallest elephant that's ever been seen. And here in Melbourne, in the Department of Zoology, I had a very good PhD student, Anne Gaith. And I said, Anne, I've got these amazing early elephant embryos. Your PhD project is to serially section them, because no one's ever serially sectioned an elephant embryo ever. And goodness knows what you'll find. And Anne goes away and sections them and comes up to my office and said, Roger, can you come and have a look? The kidneys look most peculiar. And I said, well, I don't know anything about the embryology of the kidney. I'll get my wife, Marilyn, to come and have a look. And we looked down the microscope, and there we saw these amazing structures in the kidney, which are called nephrostomes, which were little tubules penetrating the whole surface of the kidney, ending up in little glomeruli, so that it was a way of bailing out the peritoneal cavity and siphoning that fluid directly into the kidney. And elephants had got them. And no other mammal has nephrostomes in its kidney. So Marilyn said, well, those structures are nephrostomes. They are a way of bailing out fluid from the peritoneal cavity. And they're only found in aquatic animals. The elephant must be aquatic. And I thought, God, hey, the trunk's a snorkel. Wouldn't that be fantastic? And so we then thought, well, let's have a look at the trunk. And I dissected one or two young elephant fetuses, and I had noticed something strange, that the lungs were stuck to the chest wall. And I hadn't paid too much attention to it. And then I looked up in an American veterinary review, and it said that it's amazing that every single elephant that's died in captivity has had pleurisy because the lungs are stuck to the chest wall. And I thought, oh, probably that's normal. And so we looked at these early embryos and fetuses, and yes, very, very early on, the lungs stick to the chest wall and there is no pleural cavity at all. And we did some work with a very good respiratory physiologist in San Diego who spent his life looking at respiration. And he said, if you were a snorkeler, you know that you're not allowed to have a snorkel tube that's much longer than that, because if you do, you will actually rupture the blood vessels in your chest cavity. And so it's illegal to have a longer snorkel tube. And here's an elephant with a snorkel tube that's about sort of 8 foot long. And they couldn't possibly snorkel were it not for the fact that they've managed to glue their lungs to the chest wall so they can't get a pneumothorax, which is what you or I would get.
Yes. Would the elephants have been living presumably in rivers or lakes rather than anything out to sea?
Yes. I don't think they were in sort of the deep ocean, although they crossed large expanses of sea to get to remote islands off the coast of California. Santa Catalina Island has got these elephant remains on it, and it had never been part of mainland California, so how had elephants got there? They'd swum. And David Attenborough's got lovely shots of elephants swimming underwater in the Indian Ocean. And now that most fish have disappeared from the North Sea, the trawlers are trawling up the sandbanks across the North Sea and coming up with all these amazing elephant remains, of which I've got quite a selection here, from tusks to vertebrae to teeth. And mammoths, as they were then, were swimming across the North Sea between England and Scotland and Europe. And they've really been great aquatic animals, and of course they're herbivores. And we've been able to do their DNA recently, their mitochondrial DNA. And guess what their closest relative is? The dugong.
Really?
And elephants and dugongs arose from a common ancestor called Anthropocoon, which I saw the first complete skeleton of in northern Hokkaido just recently.
Now, 1968, Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb, a very political book, and I wonder whether your attitudes to population had the same sort of political underlay.
Well, I think I haven't really been a campaigner, and Paul Ehrlich's book really hit the press. I have to say I wasn't terribly impressed with it because I thought it was a bit too extreme. And I decided that I'd spend my time, after I'd left Cambridge and gone to Edinburgh for 10 years to direct a medical research council unit on reproduction, I'd look at what were the normal constraints to human fertility, how had human numbers been kept in check, what kept births spaced. And of course it turned out to be breastfeeding, and we did quite a lot of work on that to show that in traditional societies, like in Australian Aboriginal communities even today, if a mother exclusively breastfeeds her baby, which is the normal behaviour, that will, the act of suckling will stop ovulation, and the normal birth interval in traditional human societies was about 4 years or a bit more. And it's only when we discovered cow's milk and the fact that we could shortcut the breast and feed babies with cow's milk through a bottle that, whoops, fertility shot up. And instead of having one child every 4 years, you could have one child a year or less. And so that had a staggering impact on human fertility. And then when in 1960, Gregory Pincus and Min-Chue Chang at the Worcester Foundation in the States were doing their work on trying to find if you could use hormones to suppress ovulation, they showed that if you used derivatives of progesterone, which you gave to rabbits either by mouth or by injection or into the vagina, a gestagen would stop the rabbit from ovulating. And that was the discovery that led the way to the first development of the oral contraceptive pill, which came on the market 50 years ago, give or take a couple of weeks. And I think the discovery of the pill was sort of amazing. And we did quite a bit of work on this in Edinburgh, looking to see just what women felt about the pill, because you took it in such a way that you had a period once a month. And I wrote a paper called Why Menstruate? Which caused quite a stir, and said, why don't women take the pill more continuously? And you need never have a period if you don't want one. But I asked Pincus why he didn't advocate this when the pill was first discovered. And he said, it was so revolutionary for a woman to think of taking something by mouth that would be a contraceptive, that we didn't want to also confuse it with the other revolution of not being cursed with monthly menstrual periods.
Do you mean to say that if you keep taking the pill, you don't necessarily have to have any kind of menstrual cycle?
Absolutely. And we did quite a big study on 100 women. We said we're going to call this the tricycle pill. You take it for 3 months at a time and then have your withdrawal bleed, so you only have 4 menstruations a year. And I always love the definition of menstruation. It is the womb weeping for its lost lover. Isn't that lovely?
But there are no long-term effects? The body doesn't change?
No. And there's a big paper just come out in the British Medical Journal, an amazing study of over 20,000 women who've been followed for 29 years, who've been either taking the pill or a control group who've never taken it, showing that the pill has spectacular benefits. I mean, it halves your risk of cancer of the ovary, which is a really nasty cancer, and cancers of the uterus. And if you breastfeed, you protect yourself very significantly against breast cancer, which really is a nasty. And this all goes back to some observations made in a nunnery in Genoa 300 years ago, when they noticed the nuns were all coming down with breast cancer. And breast cancer is an occupational disease of nuns. So there's a message here for the Catholic Church. If Pope Benedict would allow it, all nuns should go on the pill continuously because it would save their lives. But of course he's labelled the pill as one of the new deadly sins.
And so did any of that bring you into conflict with the established church or churches?
Oh yes, had a lovely encounter with George Pell when he was Archbishop of Melbourne. He wrote to the Vice-Chancellor, Mal Logan, saying it had come to his attention that I was distributing condoms to the medical students in class. This practice must cease. So I was summoned to Mal Logan's office, and Mal said, well, Roger, we've got this letter from the Archbishop. What do you propose to do about it? And I said, well, I'd like to think about it. Could you give me a week to think of a reply? And he said, yes, no more. So I went straight back to my office and got in contact with my lifelong friend, Mechai Viravaidya, in Bangkok.
Mr. Condom.
Mr. Condom. And I said, Mechai, could you urgently make me 200 T-shirts with the following logo? Don't use Vatican condoms. They're holy. And so I got this packet of 200 T-shirts, and I dished them out to all the medical students. And I saved one and took it to Mal Logan and gave it to him. And he was absolutely horrified. His jaw dropped. But his wife was standing beside him, and she roared with laughter. And I knew that we'd won the argument. So we never bothered to reply to Archbishop Pell, now Cardinal Pell. And I don't think he's ever forgiven me.
And this is Professor Roger Short talking to me on The Science Show, ABC Radio National.
Well, now I'd like to talk about sex, and especially your absolutely marvellous book, Ever Since Adam and Eve. How come?
Well, Malcolm Potts, who was the director of Family Health International in the United States, in North Carolina, he and I had been friends since university days in Cambridge. And he'd asked me to chair the board of directors of Family Health International, which is running family planning programs all over the world. And we went out to have a coffee, as one does. And Malcolm said, you know, the two of us have got such interesting experiences in the field of reproduction. Why don't we write a book? And so we pulled a table napkin out. We still got it somewhere, a white napkin. And with a biro, we wrote the 12 chapters of the book. And I said, oh, that would be great fun to do. And then he said, well, I've got a friend who is connected with WNET in Boston, and maybe they'd like to do a television program of it first, and we could write the television programs. And I said, well, that'd be fabulous. So we wrote what became Ever Since Adam and Eve to start with as a television series, and WNET had an election and changed the chairman of the board, who'd previously been a man, to a woman, who said, well, a book on sex just by two men, won't consider it. That project's cancelled. And so here we were left with the television treatments, and we'd actually started filming in the highlands of Papua New Guinea and got some amazing film. And we thought, well, okay, well, we'll do a book. And so that's how we got to write the book.
Was any of the footage used on camera?
No, and it's pretty amazing footage, some of which I don't know that I can actually even mention on this interview. It's too sensitive. But one lovely sequence about old men in the highlands of New Guinea When they're feeling really old, they know that they're getting old because their male reproductive function fails, they can't ejaculate anymore. And so they know they've got to get some fresh semen if they're going to continue living. So they're told to climb to the top of this mountain where there is a tree that, if you cut it, exudes a white sap. And if you eat that sap, it will rejuvenate your ejaculate. And of course, they all die on the ascent.
Ah, so it's a kindness.
Yeah.
I see.
And it's a lovely form of euthanasia.
There have been any number of books about sex, but yours was distinguished by not being too pious, not at all pious, and absolutely about fun.
Yes, we thought that by structuring the book, that you had the little sort of box inserts, which were snippets of interesting information, to leaven the text, and then to try and use, wherever possible, classical paintings, drawings, to show the antiquity of our interest in coming to terms with sex. It might end up not being a sexy book, and that's why we tried to give it a non-sexy title. And it's been exciting that it's been translated into several languages. The Italian edition is absolutely beautiful, with some lovely Italian paintings, which I was unaware of, and a Spanish edition and a Korean edition, strangely, and a Chinese edition, which has deleted all the illustrations, which is rather a shame. And then Cambridge University Press said, we're going to have to stop publishing this book. It's become too popular, and we're making a profit from selling it. And if we show them to make a profit, that puts us at odds with the charity commissioners. So we are ceasing production of CUP. We've sold every single copy of the second edition we've produced, and we won't produce any more. And I said, but surely that's crazy, isn't it? You're meant to be an academic press. And they said, no, we're governed by the charity commissioners. This was actually the treasurer of CUP told me this. So University of California Press in Berkeley said, oh, we'll take it over. So they now produce it as a DVD, which sells for $1, and as a softback, which sells for $10. And so it's kept in print.
Well, sex had obviously been a part of everyday life for the whole of human history, apart from during a period of a couple of hundred years, who knows, when there was this new sense of prohibition. Where did that come from?
I think it was the perfect vehicle to monopolize in order to control people. And I always like the analogy, a bit in the mouth of a stallion, so that every time he moves his head, he feels the bit and he knows there's someone sitting up there controlling him. And to prohibit whatever aspect of normal human sexuality you want to, and different religions have chosen different bits, means that every time you think of it, and you do many times a day, it's like, oh, there's a rider up there. And it's a very powerful way of controlling societies. But there's been a very exciting development within the last few weeks, actually. It goes back a few years, and I was sitting at Imperial College in London next to Lord Winston, Robert Winston, who you know, and we were at an international twins conference, and there were 600 of us, and the last speaker was Thomas Bouchard from Minnesota. And Thomas stood up and said, well, I've spent the whole of my life working on the behaviour of identical twins reared apart. And today is my last lecture, because tomorrow I retire. And I've saved my most important discovery until this moment. And here you are, 600 of you, expert on twins, and you will not know the answer to the question I'm just going to pose to you, which I have solved. The question is this: what is the only type of behavior that will always be identical in both twins, regardless of whether they've been adopted into different environments or not? There's only one of all the types of behavior you can think of in which both twins always behave identically. What is it? And I remember turning to Robert Winston and saying, well, I haven't a clue, have you? And Robert said, no, I don't know what he's on about. And there was absolute silence. And Thomas Bouchard said, well, I'll tell you, it's religiosity. and I nearly fell through the floor. I thought, my God, how amazing that there's a God gene. And I was talking to Nick Martin at the Academy the other day, and he said, yes, he said that they now think they've got it mapped on chromosome 9. And it is a gene or group of genes that control faith. And as Nicholas Wade, the brilliant British-American New York Times writer, has shown in his latest book called The Faith Instinct, which came out just before Christmas, must read for you. He's looked at all human societies and shown how it absolutely was essential to live as a society with this common belief system which united you. And, okay, the gene has passed me by, but it's given me a new respect for the church. And I was talking to Richard Dawkins last year and have been corresponding with him recently, saying, Richard, you got it wrong. You wrote the God delusion. Actually, it's the Dawkins delusion, because you've totally dismissed God, whereas the concept of faith in something, it doesn't have to be a God, but it's a uniting spiritual belief, it is deep within our genes and has been responsible for social cohesion of communities. And if you want to take it one stage further, how tragic. And maybe I should, if he would speak to me again, get back to George Pell and say, you know, isn't it tragic that the Catholic Church has chosen to prevent those who are most likely to have the God gene from reproducing?
But, okay, a gene for God, I don't really go along with that, because people like Robin Dunbar, who's now in Oxford, have written about the evolution of the brain, saying it's more a case of there being not a particular protein, you know, a gene and therefore a protein that has some sort of God effect, but there being, in human beings, a feeling for the wider community. In other words, what you're looking at with your sophisticated brain is something far more cultural and widespread rather than godlike. Could that be it?
Yes, I agree with that completely. And, for example, Nicholas Wade has a lovely chapter on the Australian Aboriginal belief systems. Okay, they don't have a god, but they have a real spiritual concept that's a unifying theme, and it differs a bit between differing communities. And it would be fascinating to study that. If I was starting life again, I think I'd love to go and look at that.
Okay, talking about sex, where did your ideas about citrus fruits, limes and lemons, come in as a possible way of combating AIDS?
Well, I'm glad you've raised it, because I think one of the hardest things in life is to prove yourself completely wrong. And that is what I've done with the lemon juice. And it was a few years ago that, sitting in this room with Jonica, doing a program for the ABC on lemons, I was full of enthusiasm, because we'd shown that lemon juice is a very effective spermicide because of its acidity, got a pH of about 2.4. It irreversibly immobilizes sperm within a second of contact. And we know that Casanova died a wealthy man because he didn't have any alimony to pay to his mistresses, because he insisted that they all used half a lemon and put in the vagina before sex. And that's still one of the most effective contraceptives that we know of, because of the lemon juice coming up against the cervix, plus the mechanical barrier of the lemon peel stopped any sperm getting through the cervix. And what we did was to really take up Casanova's finding, check out the spermicidal effect of the lemon juice, and confirm absolutely that it's amazingly effective as a spermicide, and then look at what it did to HIV, and find that HIV, we've known for quite some time, is extremely sensitive to low pH. And in the laboratory, lemon juice, provided you could get the pH down to about 4, would instantly kill HIV. And so we thought, right, we've discovered a new role for an antique treatment of contraception which could actually protect women from HIV. So maybe it's a mistake to talk to the media about your inspired ideas, because 99% of your ideas are wrong, but I did have quite a lot of media coverage, which helped because we were able to raise from physicians in Australia and New Zealand about $15,000 and mount a clinical trial in Jos, Nigeria, of prostitutes, some of whom were already using lemon juice and had been for a decade or more, and some who never used it. And we've just published the results with a lovely Nigerian who was David de Kretser and my student at Monash, Godwin Imade, who's in the Department of Obstetrics in Jos, and he's the first author on the paper. And we looked at 398 female sex workers in Jos, a quarter of whom said they were using lemon juice either just before or just after sex as a douche, and three quarters of whom said they never used it. And these girls had never been tested for HIV, so we tested them all, and the results showed that exactly 48% of both groups were HIV positive. No evidence of any beneficial effect of the douching. And I was shattered to actually shoot yourself down in flames.
But having an experiment that doesn't actually come off, it shows you a negative, that's good science, surely.
Although it really hurts your ego. And Kipling, isn't it? If you can keep your faith when those about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you.
So that's just one study. Does that mean the whole experiment is over? Surely not.
No. We've decided that it wasn't a very good study because it's a cross-sectional study. And the thing we couldn't control was whether the girls were using the lemon juice before sex or after sex. And the difficulty is, if you think about the yucky details, how can you be sure that the few millilitres of lemon juice that you're putting into the vagina adequately mix with the whole of the ejaculate? And that's probably where it lets you down. So what we've done is to use the balance of the money that's left from these generous donations of the Australian and New Zealand physicians to make sure that every female sex worker is tested for HIV and that all those who are HIV positive in Jos are now on antiretroviral therapy. So actually it has in the end benefited them, but we're not planning another study. We've come across with another development which could be exciting. I've always said, lecturing to the medical students, and this is where I think my veterinary background helps, because you can think comparatively as a vet. I mean, I always like the phrase, you go to a vet to get doctored, but you go to a doctor to get vetted.
Yes.
And there's a nice sort of...
And there's also a T-shirt that says, a real doctor treats more than one species.
Yes, yes. So I've always said to the medical students, you know, if you think of the male and female reproductive tract, the foreskin is to the glans penis of the male, as the vagina is to the clitoris of the female. They're exactly homologous structures. And we know that the vagina is extremely sensitive to estrogen. And nature's designed that because the only time the female reproductive tract is going to be exposed to an influx of potential pathogens is as a result of sexual intercourse. So you want to make sure that intercourse is occurring when the whole of the vagina is maximally defended. And the best defense is to use the estrogen made in the ovary for the follicle that's about to ovulate to keratinize the lining of the vagina, which is exactly what it does. And so I thought, golly, if I believe what I teach, that the foreskin is the homologue of the vagina, let's see if estrogen has any effect on the foreskin. And so I borrowed some of my wife's postmenopausal estrogen cream called Ovestin, which is the compound estriol, and put it on my foreskin. You don't need ethics approval if you do it on yourself. Physician, heal thyself. And within 24 hours, I've keratinized the inside of my foreskin.
How can you tell?
No difference in feeling at all. And although you could see a difference because you could no longer see the fine capillaries because the keratin had occluded them. So I thought, gosh, this is amazing. So I did a little study on myself and then got one of my colleagues to repeat it on himself. And we published this in PLOS One, the exciting new online journal for the Public Library of Science, on May the 5th, 2008. And just prior to that, we decided to patent it. Melbourne University said they paid for the provisional patent, but said no, they didn't want to be involved in the definitive patent because this was a discovery that would really only benefit developing countries, and they weren't interested, which I thought was amazing. So I paid all the patenting costs out of my pension.
And the idea is, of course, that this treatment can keep the HIV out.
Yes. So if we wash our hands in a pure culture of HIV, provided we don't have hangnails, we're not going to get infected, because HIV cannot get through keratin. And if you can generate this keratin on the inside of the foreskin, where it's not normally there, you can stop HIV entering the penis. And we're at a very exciting stage. As recently as Friday last week, I was at Monash discussing with colleagues there, we would like to donate the patent rights for South Africa, which we filed in, to Monash South Africa, to see if we can do a trial of this cream in the South African army, which has a 26% incidence of HIV, which is so high that the head of the army has declared that it is no longer an effective fighting force, which is just sort of staggering. And we think that if we gave these troops, the recruits that the army takes in, who are all screened for HIV before they taken into the defence force, if we gave them this cream and said, all you've got to do this is put a little bit of this on your foreskin once a week, and we think there's no way that HIV could get in, because we've shown abundantly, and it's just been confirmed in the last couple of weeks, that it's the inside of the foreskin where HIV gets into the penis, and hence the amazing protective effect of male circumcision, which gives you at least a 50% protection. And that, I think, depends on how much of the foreskin you actually remove in the circumcision. So here we are, a very exciting phase. We've made the discovery, we've published it, it's caused a lot of interest. We've got a patent, and we've got a patent which is also in the United States, where the main manufacturer of estriol cream for women is. And they've never even thought that it might have an effect in men. And I think when they wake up to the fact that we've got a patent on their product, they might be interested. And it would be nice to be able to donate the patent to, first of all, South Africa, and then next we would like to donate it to India and really help them contain their HIV pandemics.
I was with Professor Roger Short. Formerly of Monash, he now spends most of his time at the University of Melbourne. My thanks to the Academy of Science for help with that recording. Next week, New Zealand and some island sanctuaries for rare creatures. On Catalyst, and Roger Short will be very interested in this one, Jonathan Newby reports on premenstrual tension, why it happens and how to treat it. Catalyst on Thursday at 8, ABC One. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams, and the music is from Schubert's Quintet in C.